This is a pretty cool title to have on your business card. Scott Silverstone is an ASU Future of War Fellow at New America and a professor of international relations at the United States Military Academy at West Point. He is here this morning to talk about his new book, From Hitler's Germany to Saddam's Iraq, The Enduring False Promise of Preventive War. The book challenges conventional wisdom about the value of preventive war, beginning with the rise of German power and the French and British response to the Rhineland crisis, leading to World War II. Silverstone overturns the common impulse to point an accusing finger at British leadership for its alleged naivete, willful blindness, or outright cowardice. Instead, he argues that that crisis is a critical case for studying a central dynamic of world history, power shifts among states, and the preventive war temptation that power shifts frequently produce. Again, the name of the book, From Hitler's Germany to Saddam's Iraq, The Enduring False Promise of Preventive War. It is a great pleasure to welcome Scott Silverstone to the roundtable.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks
for
having
me. Well, it's a delight to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us. So let's begin here. Baseline, how do we define preventive war?
So preventive war is a strategy to deal with shifting power. And if you think about this as a very common historic phenomenon, as you see a rival growing in power, it creates fear of the future. And if you look down the road 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, if your rival continues to develop new weapon systems, grow its army, becoming more powerful than it is today, there grows a temptation to pull the trigger now, while you still have some kind of advantage, to destroy the capabilities that really haunt your visions of the future. And the concern is pretty straightforward. What if I actually go to war 2 years, 5 years from now with this rising power? It'll come at a much higher cost. Doesn't it make strategic sense to take the initiative to somehow engineer a conflict and use your relative advantage now to neutralize this threat as you see it developing over the future?
So in other words, in bar fight terms, hit them when they're not looking.
Hit them when they're not looking. Your neighbor is working out, he's practicing karate, and you worry that someday he may confront you. So before he develops his skills, why not take him down in the meantime?
Just for the record, never been in a bar fight. Okay. but it is interesting because that seems intuitive, right? That's somewhat intuitive to think, oh, well, we'll take care of this problem before it becomes more of a problem.
It is intuitive, so you understand the temptation, right? The logic is pretty clear. But the problem inherent in thinking about what does the future hold is that we have discovered there's tremendous research on how poor our ability to predict the future is. With enough clarity to say I am taking a reasonable risk, that pulling the trigger now, inviting all the potential costs of war, will actually save me from some higher calamity in the future. The fact is, we don't have a crystal ball. And there are so many examples of preventive wars that were almost fought but weren't. And with the advantage of hindsight, being able to look back and realize it would have been a tragic mistake to actually go to war when the rivalry tended to fizzle out over time. So how do you make decisions today about a potential risk in the future when you have no real solid way to understand whether or not you're actually going to face that threat?
So what is the counter, the alternative to preventive war?
I think the alternative is classic balance of power politics. And this is how...
Is that diplomacy?
It could be diplomacy. So much of thinking about the logic of preventive war finds the source of threat in the physical power of the other state. And the idea is if you can neutralize, if you can destroy the physical power, you will be more secure in the future. But so much of the threat that you face is not merely a function of the physical power that your rival has. It's their actual intention to act aggressively in the future. So through either diplomacy and working to diffuse tensions, to minimize the likelihood of conflict, or if you're going to find yourself in a conflictual relationship, have the kind of deterrent power to restrain your adversary from actually acting aggressive because he knows he'll pay a price for attacking you. So balancing, diplomacy, that's the traditional tool as opposed to preventive war, taking the initiative with military force.
So let's just take North Korea as an example. So we become increasingly concerned over the last decade of that country's nuclear capabilities. And so what do you do in that sense? What is the right thing to do?
This is a great case, and we have seen just in the last year and a half an active consideration of the preventive war option within the Trump administration. So if you go back to the summer of 2017 and the president's tweets about fire and fury and the response by President Kim Jong-un, this idea of delivering American power against North Korea's nuclear infrastructure, against its missiles, has been part of the package that the administration has studied. But take this case back to 1994. In June of 1994, President Clinton came very close to authorizing preventive attacks when the North Koreans first threatened to pull out of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and they did have a nuclear infrastructure. And at the time, Secretary of Defense William Perry was advocating very passionately on behalf of preventive war. He was saying, Mr. President, we cannot sit by and allow the North Korean regime to develop this capability. If we go to war with the North Koreans 5 years from now, 10 years from now, after they've developed a nuclear arsenal of, say, 50, it'll come at a hellacious cost. At the same time in 1994, President Clinton's being told by his commander in Korea, if we fight a purely conventional war, it will cost 1 million casualties and $1 trillion. So that's the choice President Clinton had to make. How do I make the decision about the future safety in our relationship with North Korea? Should I absorb 1 million casualties, $1 trillion, to prevent what? We don't know. Here we are 25 years later, and of course the North Koreans continue to develop their nuclear capabilities, but we actually haven't fought North Korea. Was it a mistake by President Clinton not to pull the trigger? We simply don't know. In the meantime, we have had a combination of diplomacy, of sanctions to put pressure on North Korea, and ultimately, our policy really depends on deterring North Korea because North Korea knows if it ever lashes out in an aggressive way, the regime will be destroyed. So most of American strategy is simply resting on deterrence of Korean aggression.
I promise I'll get back to the basis of the book. But as we sit here, I get a flash across from the New York Times that says a new American intelligence assessment of global threats has concluded that North Korea is, quote, unlikely to give up, end quote, all of its nuclear stockpiles and that Iran is not, quote, currently undertaking the key nuclear weapons development activity, unquote, needed to make a bomb, directly contradicting two top tenets of President Trump's foreign policy. Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, also challenged Mr. Trump's insistence that the Islamic State had been defeated, a key rationale for his decision to exit from Syria. Those are three big things, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I'm frankly not surprised that this is the finding that's coming out of the national intelligence community. So once again, it confronts us with this question. There was an active debate back in the mid-2000s about using military force to destroy Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And through diplomacy, we have actually placed a cap on the development of Iran's potential nuclear weapons growth. And this is something that clearly the Director of National Intelligence is supporting.
So when it comes to is it unprecedented with your view of history, is it unprecedented to see the president of the United States at odds with the his own people in charge of our national intelligence?
It is not unprecedented. It's perhaps unprecedented to have it this out in the open, to have this much apparent
light
disagreement.
On it?
That's right. And clearly, these are incredibly difficult questions, and you have to appreciate how tough it is. Going back to this problem of the inherent uncertainty of the future, how do you make decisions today about rising threats when you don't have a crystal ball. So inevitably, it's going to cause tremendous disagreement over how do you assess the future threat? How do you assess the value of using military force today as opposed to other options? So the disagreement is not surprising. You usually don't see it this public.
The subtitle of the book is The Enduring False Promise of Preventative War. Scott Silverstone is our guest this half hour. The Enduring False Promise of Preventive War. I like asking the question a lot, which is, okay, but what have, you know, haven't we learned anything? haven't we learned from our mistakes? And in reading this book, as you say, from Hitler's Germany to Saddam's Iraq, it appears that we have not.
It is a lesson that every single generation has to learn for itself, because what's so fascinating about this problem?
Okay, now, right. Let me just stop you there.
Right.
But it really, I mean, we have to learn the lesson. We can't have someone out and say, look, you know, if you put a match on fire, it blows up.
Great point. So let me rephrase. They shouldn't learn through actually trying the strategy. They should actually study the history of preventive war and ask themselves, under what conditions have we seen it work? And frankly, from my review of literally 2,500 years of history, there are virtually no cases, very few cases, in which it's actually made the state that launched the preventive war more safe. It's typically created a backlash. It is actually provided just a short window of time after you launch this attack, after you use military force. But over the long term, all it does is it increases the hostility, increases the desire for revenge, increases the likelihood that you're actually going to get into a significant military conflict in the future. So the best we can do is go back to these critical historic cases and study the temptation, understand that we may feel the temptation too, but there are clear patterns in which preventive war has actually produced much greater dangers over the long term for every state that's initiated it.
You write, as you said, 2,500 years of history in this book and 270 pages, so good for you. Well done, sir. But you really do, in the examination, the good starting point is Hitler's Germany, right?
That's right. I picked this case. It really is the centerpiece of the book because it's an iconic historical case. And this is one of these cases that seems to serve up the opposite lesson. The way we typically look back at the 1930s and the years leading into World War II is to say, with the advantage of hindsight, how could they have been so blind, right? We've all heard this argument that wasn't the likelihood of aggression by Nazi Germany so crystal clear that the British, the French, other like-minded states, why didn't they find a moment in time to confront Germany violently if necessary to neutralize the growing threat that Germany posed through the 1930s? And the way we typically look back at this, and in 1936, really is the story at the heart of my book, in the Rhineland crisis. And the Rhineland crisis had to do with Adolf Hitler moving a relatively small military force west of the Rhine River in violation of the Versailles Treaty that ended World War I. It created a very significant crisis that burned for several months. The French were actually willing to use military force to push the Germans back across the Rhine River and restore this buffer zone that had been created there. But they made it contingent on British political support, and the British vetoed it. Ever since then, it's been looked at as this golden opportunity, a lost opportunity to stop World War II. Now, that's an amazingly powerful claim, if true. And we have seen this moment in time, 1936, mobilized in the last 15 years in the debate about war with Iraq in 2002, 2003. We've seen it in the debate over whether or not we should attack Iran. And we've seen it raised in the case of North Korea. Don't be like the British and French. Attack Iraq. Attack Iran. Attack North Korea. So we need to go back to this case and ask ourselves, what does the 1930s really teach us about the alternatives we have today?
Have there been other war powers besides us who have done this successfully in the sense of not falling for this false promise of preventive war?
Well, the United States itself, there was an active debate in the early 1950s, in the early Cold War, over whether or not the United States should use its atomic monopoly before the Soviets had actually developed both the bomb and then an arsenal that could deliver a nuclear blow against the United States. And there were a number of key strategic thinkers in America who were arguing that we would be foolish to sit back on this monopoly and allow Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union to develop the capability to literally destroy the United States. And they were estimating by 1957, this is in the early 50s, by 1957, the Soviets would have the ability to destroy America. And they believed the Soviets were motivated to do this. So the pressure percolated. Both President Truman and President Eisenhower decisively rejected this advice. And only today can we look back and realize that this was a potential tragedy, given the fact that the Cold War ran its course and ended peacefully. So we've seen the temptation to launch preventive wars rejected in a number of cases. And with the advantage of time, we can judge that to be a smart decision.
Are there... I have a question about national character. It seems that as we look through history, and we, I mean, Russia being the obvious one here, right? That we look at them and okay, how are we going to play nice? And these are questions that continue to this day. But we see this throughout our history. So are enemies always going to be our enemies? Are our friends always going to be our friends? And then my quick follow-up is, what's the rest of the world saying about us right now?
Clearly, over time, enemies don't remain enemies and friends don't necessarily remain friends. We've seen over and over again, just in our own history, that with time, rivalries emerge and rivalries fade. So you clearly can't assume that every rivalry is going to reach a boiling point and turn violent. Many of them, of course, fade with time.
Right.
How the rest of the world looks at the United States, I guess in the context of preventive war, one of the things that we faced back in the early 2000s was this tremendous pushback when the United States began the march toward war against Iraq. And the overwhelming assessment wasn't that Iraq didn't necessarily have weapons of mass destruction. Remember, that was the main argument.
Right.
That was the preventive war argument for taking down Saddam Hussein. We don't want him to allow – we don't allow him to continue developing nuclear weapons to the point where he might actually use them someday. Most of the world actually challenged the wisdom and the necessity of using military force to deal with this potential threat, and they believe that there are other ways of doing this. So frankly, in that time period, many countries around the world were looking at the United States as frankly not having a very reasonable approach to this problem.
The fact is that for the last 18 years, we have been in a state of war in this country. And so we're talking about taking troops out. We talked with your colleague, Jim Ketterer, this morning about this very issue. What do you do? What do you do in the sense of you don't want to... the concern is, and it seems like a valid concern, if you take the troops out, that things could implode. Obviously, the longer you leave troops in there, the more casualties you could face, the more trouble you can face down the road. So we can argue about how we got into this, but what do we do to get out of it?
Well, I think everything hinges on how we define a reasonable end state, how we define our strategic goals, how ambitious our strategic goals should be. One of the core arguments that I make in this book is that in the United States, we too often confuse operational military success with strategic success. We can deliver
I'm sorry, say that again.
Operational military success with strategic success.
Okay.
Any use of military force has to be judged not based on whether you can accomplish immediate military objectives, overthrowing a regime, taking a hill, seizing an objective. the only way to evaluate the success of any use of military power is the political outcome that you produce. What is it actually that you're trying to leave behind? So in the case of preventive war, just being able to destroy Iran's nuclear infrastructure doesn't necessarily mean we achieve the strategic end of being safer from a future Iranian threat. In the case of Afghanistan, if we want to define the end state as a Western-leaning, more liberal society with an open representative government, then we have a mighty tall hill to climb in terms of the ambitions of our strategic goals. If our strategic goals are much more limited in terms of preventing Afghanistan from once again being a safe haven for groups like al-Qaeda, who have global power projection capabilities or intentions as a terrorist organization, it's a much less ambitious goal that can be handled through residual forces, as you were talking about this morning, that may be able to suppress that threat, but not try to reform the entire Afghan government.
So when do you put up the mission accomplished banner?
Our initial goal was achieved back in 2002. Our goal was to neutralize Afghanistan as a safe haven for al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was on the run, and al-Qaeda has been largely crippled relative to its strength back in 2001. So they could have put up the mission accomplished banner. But you go back to your point about national character. One of the things we like in the United States, we like clean solutions. We like to walk away from problems, think of ourselves as problem solvers,
right,
as leaving something clean behind. A full solution. We don't like messy, open-ended problems. So, frankly, if we're looking for a clean solution in Afghanistan that we can be proud of, I don't think we're going to get there.
But to your point, though, as we like a clean solution, but that clean solution would bring men and women home. And that, or not send them there in the first place, right? I mean, it seems like that's not such a bad thing. I understand it's not always achievable, but for this dragging on for 18 years, obviously that's not good.
It's been dragging on for 18 years, I think, because we've had very high hopes for creating an Afghani government that was representative. And frankly, this is such an ambitious mission. How long do we have to stay there to actually achieve it?
Well, and that's it. And the final point, I'm going to end with something that's, I guess, a huge issue, but you touch on that in the book. At the time when we were making this decision to invade Iraq, many military professionals, people like yourself, not including, I don't know what your position was, but many military professionals were saying, okay, but you can't just go in there without knowing what you're going to do and how you're going to stabilize the region. And, well, that turned out to be exactly the case, right? We didn't listen to that advice.
That's right. That was the advice. The belief within the core of the Bush administration at the time was that all human beings are natural little Jeffersonian Democrats. Every human being, doesn't matter where they come from, what their culture is, their historic context, they all appreciate freedom, liberty. If you knock off the tyrants, they will gladly participate in rebuilding an open liberal society, free markets. And clearly, this wasn't the political context that we faced in Iraq. So the Bush administration frankly felt that by the end of 2003, we could have the American military down to about 5,000 troops. And they're in an advisory capacity to provide some basic security functions. But they believed it was going to be a quick mission and would solve the potential future problem of a nuclear-armed Saddam Hussein forever.
The book is fascinating and really helps you understand what's going on. And I highly recommend it for that purpose alone. From Hitler's Germany to Saddam's Iraq, The Enduring False Promise of Preventive War. It is published by Roman and Littlefield. Scott Silverstone, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have your expertise on the program.
Great being here, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, From Hitler's Germany to Saddam's Iraq, by Scott Silverstone. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.